a number of things that we need to address for the greater good of the organization, and because we're very, very busy people. So I'm going to start out with turning it over to Maya, who's going to talk about something fun, and that's Bring Your Child to Work Day. If anybody has an extra 8 to 12-year-old or whatever, I'll borrow them.
Great, so that's what I'm here to talk to you about. It's Bring a Child to Work Day, which is happening on May 10th of this year. This is an event that's been initiated from the principal herself, and it's an event that gives you an opportunity to bring kids from ages 8 to 15 onto campus to take part in a number of different activities that will be happening that will kind of highlight all of the different kinds of work and research and things that happen across campus. So it's a form of community outreach. This is something that we've been involved with for a couple of months now, and the library is actually offering three different activities on that day. So we have Greg in digitization, who will be offering cartoon creation, showing off some of the different digitization projects, the robotic arm scanner, but also giving kids an opportunity to do flipbook animation and animate on the computer as well. And then we have a really fun activity that's happening over at the Osler Library with Anna, a medieval med school. So that you're actually going to have a chance to come on with children who are interested to learn how to be a medieval doctor and do a little bit of fake urine analysis and astrological charts. So that's going to be a great activity as well. And then the final activity is a drop-in activity that I'm offering up at the Education Library, just doing some simple book creation. So those are three activities. The way the day works is you would have a child, either your own child, a grandchild, or a child, someone you're close to, who will, like just like Colleen said, could borrow somebody else's kid for a day. But within that age, 8 to 15 age bracket, because that's really what the activities across campus are being offered to. So there's lots of things happening. Security has some kind of zombie apocalypse planned. There's also creating comets, some cave stone tools from the archaeology department. All kinds of different really fun things are happening across campus. Just want to say, so yeah, ages 8 to 15, not necessarily your own, the three library activities. There's a website, which I've listed here. It's as part of the HR website, so that you can go there and check out all of the different activities. I encourage, if you are interested in participating, it's very important to first speak with your supervisor in terms of making sure that the work coverage is there for the day. So depending on how many people within your unit are going to be participating, you just need to make sure in conjunction with your supervisor that the that work is covered for that day. But it's something that we're encouraging all of our supervisors to be really flexible with, because it's a fun first activity for McGill to be trying their hand at. Registration is now open. And it's important, because of space and staff constraints, that if there are activities you're particularly interested in, that you register sooner rather than later, because they will fill up quite quickly. And if you don't have kids, but you want to participate, always looking for volunteers, I'll be happy to have people up with me at education for the morning. That's another thing that you should first speak with your supervisor about, to make sure that, like I said, that the work is covered for the day. Are there any questions about Bring a Child to Work Day that I can answer right now? Great. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. I have two kids within that age bracket, and they'll certainly be with me on campus that day, and I'll probably be putting them to work as well. But if you have any questions, you can feel free to check out the website, but also just to email me or give me a call. My extension's 4687. All right. Thank you very much.
Okay, making sure I have this pointed in the right direction. Space planning work group, Jessica.
This will be very quick. Okay. It's okay. I can use that. Yeah, okay. This is
is basically just a very, very brief update for everyone about what we were doing here. So we ran two sets of surveys in two different places. One was the furniture lab. A lot of you would have passed through it as you came through on your way up. The second was the third floor of McLennan. It was mostly A, to figure out what do students like about the furniture. That's why it was a lab. And B, also, McLennan has already been renovated on the third floor, but it was to see what people thought of those renovations. Did they like it? How are they using the space? We did two ways of doing it. We did an online print survey, and then we actually watched them, because often what people say is very different than what they do. And so these are just really, really brief highlights. We have a 100-page document that I have a link to on the slides if you want to go through all the charts. But just quick, couple quick takeaways. The furniture lab is used by students in a range of disciplines. We often think humanities is just arts, but they only made up 40% of the people who responded, so that was interesting. Mostly undergraduates. And it was mixed use. We asked them, you know, how do you like to use this space? And they were using it for group work. Quiet, it was weird. Quiet study, but there's group work and quiet study, and they want to. So they were using it for a little bit of everything. And then the observations confirmed that as well. The third floor, they really, really liked it. They said it was very effective for quiet study, and that's mostly what they were using it for. And they generally had positive comments about all the changes that were made to the third floor. And you can see here in this chart, like, how effective was it for quiet study, and it was about 90% of people said it was either effective or very effective. So we just made a couple recommendations. You know, people wanted more tables, more desk chairs, so chairs that you could actually put something on, and you will see that reflected. Some of the furniture has already changed. Whiteboards, markers, outlets, sort of the things that have come up again and again. We recommended that the furniture lab expand to include what we call the fishbowl, because right now it's a quiet study area next to a mixed-use area. And then expand quiet study to the other floors of McLennan to make up for that rearrangement of space. And then the third floor, we recommended to replicate what you did there on the other floor, since it was so positively received. And just little things like changing some of the furniture to be more efficient. In the observations, we noticed you could cram a lot more people into this configuration than you could into this one. And no one seemed to mind either way. And so that's where the big report lives, if you want to go through and look at all our different charts and graphs. And that's it.
Thank you. I guess that most of you remember, I hope everybody remembers, that Archives is now part of us. They're part of our family. We are now the Library and Archives family. But I'm not sure that everybody can put a face to a name, so we asked Teresa Roat to speak a little bit about Archives and what they're all about. And Lori.
Thank you. See if I can get this attached. Yeah. Great. And I'm in the way here. So, we're just here to give you a quick glimpse of what the activities and operations are of the archives, what the objectives are of the archives. I'm really, really grateful to have the opportunity to do this. And as Dean Cook mentioned, we've been part of the library family since last September. So, first of all, what are we? We are the stewards of McGill's historical legacy. We're responsible for the safekeeping of our documentary heritage and of our information assets. As the official repository for administrative records, we have the records management program, and that's something that Lori will speak to. And what happens with records management is that we deal with a life cycle situation where you transfer your semi-active records to us, and then from all of the vast material that we receive, we then select what has long-term historical value and what needs to be preserved forever, effectively. We're also the keeper of archival materials of historical significance. that enhance teaching and research. So there's a discretionary mandate there to acquire materials that will serve professors, that will serve students and researchers. And then finally, you'll see here, we operate as a public archives, and that is very much in the tradition of also of public libraries, for example, where the idea is we are open and accessible to all. We serve the McGill community, we serve McGill as our sponsor, shall we say, but we also offer access to our archival holdings to anyone else. Now, I'm going to turn next one to the client services, and we have a team of archivists and support staff who are involved in building the archival holdings, in providing for their care and custody, and making this great wealth of material available to our researchers. So there are a number of specific client services that Lori Podolsky, who's our manager of archives and records. Lori is probably the face that you know most, and so I'll ask her to talk about the client services.
Thank you. And I'll pass this to you. She'll do it from the back.
Okay. So probably the part that you know us most about is the part I'm going to talk to you guys about. What we do for client services is a lot of the internal stuff. So working with your administrative records, your operational records. So we receive records transfers. So for some of you, when you're ready to send your records to us, you're ready to get them out of your office because they've been there too long, taking up too much space, you give them to us and we'll take them in. We also retrieve and circulate records requested by units. So for some of you, if there's something that you need back, if you're doing space planning or you're looking at budgets, maybe looking at your mandate, you might want to know some historical information about your unit. So you will give us a call and we'll get those records for you. We'll retrieve them and send them back. We are responsible for inquiries for information contained in our holdings. So I think some of you have worked on projects like with Islamic Library and other areas where, again, you've come to us with general information and we've helped you find answers to your questions. Other things that we do when we work with more closely with digitization unit, so with Greg and Joel and Jennifer, is research and publication support, and we do scanning, citations, and intellectual property information. So again, what we're looking at there is if we have clients coming in and they need something scanned, so it could be either internal within McGill or external, we have other institutions that want to use our images, we will get them scanned, and we also look at copyright and that kind of stuff. And then also as well, we do have a consultation room, a reference room on the sixth floor. And that's open to researchers and to staff, and they can view and access our holdings there. And we've also, again, done specialized projects. Some of you have noticed we've got a McGill Remembers, and that was launched at the last homecoming, and that celebrates the veterans and people who were McGill students, staff, faculty, or associated with McGill who were involved in World War II. So their records from the War Records Office at McGill University was scanned thanks to initiatives and work done by some of our staff, such as Jean-Marc Tremblay, Gordon Burr, and some of our work study students. That was digitized and put up onto a website for us as well. And so our collection mandate, again, the archives was created in 1962. And that's when the first university archivist was hired, because there was a concern over the historical memory of McGill as an institution. In the 1980s and 1990s, as a result of Quebec legislation, the Archives Act, I'm not going to say it in French because I will really make that horrible, we actually started to get into access to information, access to records and things like that, and also getting to start collecting and preserving our historical memory. We also have an emphasis on public accountability, so that's where our records management part really comes into play. From there, we want to make sure we're accountable, we're collecting information, we're keeping it, maintaining it, and then if we no longer need it, it's met its use, then we're destroying it in a confidential manner. And we also record all of that as well, too. So it's well documented. Our updated collection mandate stresses what we call total archives. It's a holistic model, and it's also captured in the McGill University Archives Terms of Reference, which was approved by the Board of Governors. So this actually comes down from the Board of Governors rather than from an internal document. And that was approved in 2005. And it's the first part of the mandate consists of the responsibility for administrative records of the university. So there we outline the role of the university archivist and director, Teresa Rowett, outlines our unit responsibilities, maintaining and preserving the records, and also outlines your responsibility as users, creators, and that of those records. So we keep them, we transfer, the records that you create get transferred to us, and we maintain them from there. And the second part also reflects our relationship with affiliated staff and student organizations, as well as professors and individuals who study at or somehow associated with McGill. And that's where we call our private donations. This is a discretionary part of our work. And here we can collect in, and Teresa will give us some examples in a bit, some of the papers that we've collected from members of McGill University and outside people as well, and how we increase that McGill institutional memory over time. Finally, we strive to build the strong archival holdings needed to support our historical memory and also historical research. So that's another part of the of our mandate that we do. So records management, what do we do? Well, we use a life cycle approach. So from creation to cradle or to grave. And also long-term preservation, and again, it's that secure, confidential destruction. So our records management activities include systematic control. So when they come in, we give them accession numbers, we have file lists that you've provided to us, we facilitate the transfers from your office into our holdings, into our custody. We also apply the retention rules. So we have the McGill University Records Retention Schedule, or what we call MERS. So a lot of times if you're talking to us, we'll say something and we'll go, well, we'll see what the MERS, what's in the MERS. That's what we're talking about. And the MERS tells us how long we keep those records for. So do we keep them for 1 year, 5 years, 7 years, 25 years, or do we keep them permanently? And it also lets us know again what that disposition is. So are we going to be keeping or destroying them? So that's what that gives us. And that also allows us to keep those records that really reflect the history of McGill. Those are our permanent archival ones. We also promote best practices in records keeping. So we want to make sure that your information is kept in a way that is easy for you to retrieve it, find it, use it, and reuse it. And also, too, when you send it to us, we want to make sure we can retrieve it and give it back to you should you need that information in the future. And finally, what we're doing today is we're promoting records management awareness to you through things such as this, and also going out and talking to units individually and to help them with their records management. Also, too, we do have a scholarly and teaching aspect to our unit. We have, in practical terms, we also have, when we acquire and select our records, we also have them available to the public. So in the university environment, we've had students that come in and have done projects on using our records, and we've also had outside organizations come in and use our records for scholarly and teaching. Not just faculty from McGill, but faculty from outside of McGill. So that's something else that we do as well, including building our repositories. So now I'm going to let Teresa just talk a little bit about the archival and...
So I will just finish up here with a few more general comments and something about our holdings. Just want to very quickly mention to you that the way in which we approach our work is through archival practice. And so our concern is with building a holistic memory of McGill. And we're also looking particularly for things like provenance. the contextual context in which something was created, so that we can attest to the evidential value of the records that we are providing. And as a researcher, you can judge the context of those records to see whether or not is this from whose perspective it was created, for example. And that means that subsequently, down the line, many decades later, someone can say, well, this was created by the office of the principal, or this was created by librarians who had such and such a concern. And then they can understand or reinterpret that material. And then certainly in terms of how we preserve the permanent material, it has to do with long-term preservation. Our concern is for the generations to come. So there are times when we will say that people cannot access material because they are too fragile, because we need to preserve that information for the long run. Once we've selected something as permanent, there is no weeding involved beyond that. And just very quickly, here are a couple of examples of fonds that we have, the John Peters Humphrey Fonds. And John Peters Humphrey was a professor of McGill in the law faculty. He was instrumental in drafting the Declaration, the Universal Declaration on Human Rights. And it was, in fact, John Hobbins who discovered this and who has certainly valorized that fonds and had it made the contact so that we could acquire it and preserve it. We also have a very large fonds that is from the History Committee of the Japanese Canadian Cultural Association of Montreal. And Gordon Burr has been very involved in acquiring that material over the years. That contact was made also through Professor John Zuki of the History Department. And in addition to the material that came from the History Committee of the Japanese community here in Montreal, then they have given us contacts to other members of their community. And here is an example of one of those. This is the Katsuji Nakashima Fonds. And this is a member of the Japanese community who actually served in the Canadian Expeditionary Force during the First World War, rather, and then subsequently was interned as a Japanese Canadian during the Second World War. So those kinds of emotive connections can be made through some of these fonds. And we have the Madeleine Parent Fonds, and that is she was a graduate of McGill. It was Professor André Lévesque, who from the History Department, who suggested that we acquire this. Madeleine Parent recently passed away, and we have all of her materials that relate to her labor activism. She was a real defender of women in the textile industry here in Quebec and also in Ontario. Finally, my name, Teresa Rowett, Laurie Podolsky. We'll be very happy to answer any questions about, especially our records management services, because I suspect you'll be the closest to that will be the aspect of our activities that you'll be dealing with on a very regular basis. And I know that many of you refer historical questions to our unit, so I hope that gives a little bit of a context on how we operate.
Pacing through.
Yes. Yes. Thank you. I think that we will have them back when we aren't so worried about other things. But thank you very much for a very quick introduction of what our new cousins or brothers or sisters are all about. So Diane is going to deal with planning resources update and also, that's it.
The other item on the agenda.
Great. Awesome. Good morning. Just a few very brief points to bring you up to date with. Everyone knows the end of our financial year is April 31st. This is just a shout out to all of you that have traveled or have an expense report that needs to get in for this financial year. We really need you to submit it by Wednesday, April 10th, so that our office in Planning and Resources can get that to Central and paid to you. So please mark that down and start gathering your receipts and boarding passes. Just a call out to staff and librarians that volunteers and ideas are wanted for a couple of committees and workshops that are being put into place. The Mobile Apps Committee, which is co-chaired by Jill Baruff and Robin Canwell, are starting up this new committee. They are looking for committee members, so please send your expressions of interest to join that committee to me, and they'll put that committee together. The other workshops that are being planned, a big thank you to Brian McMillan for offering to plan this series of sessions, the Summer Professional Series workshops. Please submit your ideas to Brian or join his workshop planning committee at a workshop work group to put together 4 to 5 summer workshops between now and Labor Day. So just a shout out to you all, both librarians and support staff. And now, just to let you know, one of the workshops that is in place is a copyright workshop that is being organized by Amy Buckland, who will provide everyone with a brief overview of the state of copyright, fair dealing, and author rights. So I think this will be a really important one for all to participate in. And now I turn it over to Colleen. There
we go. Thank you.
Great.
Let's see if I can. Yeah. This isn't going to work. Okay. So everyone knows that we live in interesting budget times. And I am going to go over some things once again that everyone pretty much knows about and just reiterate all of it. And then I'm going to go a little bit further into how all of this is going to affect us in the library. And this is all a work in progress as we're trying to figure out exactly the impact of the budget cuts on us and what we're going to have to do in as a reaction to all of them. So I think most everyone knows already. A lot of this was done at, let me see if I can figure out how to use this. No. Bad. Okay. Get back to the slide and then show me which button I use for the laser pointer. Okay. That's the one I used before.
Just this one.
That one's the laser pointer?
Yep.
That's the laser pointer? Nope. Okay. Forget the laser pointer. I'll point at it. Okay. We have close to $43 million in expenditures, primarily in the operating budget, that we're going to have to cut. I think this is information from Tony. I think everybody knows. He sent out a memo again just this week explaining that this is real. To give you an idea of the magnitude of this cut, that is the library's budget in a good year is about $35 million total. These are recurring cuts, meaning that you can't just find the money one time and you're done. This is money that has to be cut from the university as a whole all the time, forever. Okay. Salaries and benefits make up more than 75% of the university's core operating budget. Anyone who went to the town hall meetings understands that. And we will be working to reduce a lot of this to come up with our $43 million budget cut through attrition and wage freezes. And we'll be taking a two-tiered, two-phased approach. In phase one, there will be a 3% salary cut and salary freeze for all senior administration that will take effect on the 1st of May, 2013. Just to make sure that people understand, senior administration means deans and above.
So, in effect, that affects only me. I just don't want you to feel, you know, I just want to make it clear it's only me. It doesn't affect anybody else in the library. There's a reduction from 7 to 9% in the operating budgets of the vice principal's portfolios and the offices of the principal and provost. And I can tell you that we are basically part of this structure. The library is. Phase one, there will be a one-year salary freeze for academic staff with the exception of tenure track assistant professors and librarians. So there will be a 1% across the board salary increase for our assistant librarians. And nothing else for other academic staff members except for those who are going from assistant to associate librarian with tenure. Other employee groups were asked to accept a one-year salary freeze, and there'll be news coming out with their respective internal processes, and I won't go into that here. With the exception that MAUT, with the one clear case that MAUT has agreed that academic staff will not have a salary increase. There is a hiring freeze for administrative and support staff as of April the 2nd. So that means that we will not be able to fill any of those positions that come open. A temporary freeze on position rematch and special salary requests for administrative and support staff as of this week. So essentially what this means is that we're frozen in a snapshot with what our current picture is, our current status with respect to administrative and support staff. As everyone knows, there's a voluntary retirement program for academics that is going on for academic staff, and as it is posted on the website, is still accurate. There's nothing been changed to that, so the retirement incentive program for academic staff is what it has been and will continue to be. There is a voluntary retirement program for eligible administrative and support staff defined as those who will become 60 this year, are or will become 60 in 2013 and over in age. This, just to give people an idea of how many people this is within our community, it's roughly half of within the administrative and support staff in the library, roughly half of us are eligible for this program in according to this definition. Letters were sent to home addresses to eligible administrative and support staff across the university. That was 451 employees. According to the program, or the offered program, there will be an allowance of 4 weeks of salary per year of service, not to be less than the equivalent of 26 weeks of salary or greater than 52. So if you've worked for the university for 10 years, you will receive a year of pay. What?
10 times 4 weeks.
10 times 40 weeks. Okay, 10 times.
If you worked for the university 12 years and more, you would be entitled to the
52. Okay, if you work for the university for 12 years or more, then you're entitled to a year. That's sort of the rough cutting off point of understanding where this comes. You need to make a decision. Those who are thinking about this or may be thinking about this are eligible for this, an irrevocable decision to be sent to us on or before June the 3rd at noon, and all necessary documents have been included in your package. If you lose them, I'm sure that we can find more copies for you. What's really important is that, I mean, I've done this a little bit myself. I've got most of my very good friends are a little bit older than I am, so they're thinking about retirement. and they forced me to think a little bit about retirement, and it, you have to get in the mindset. It's sort of a, it's a big transition. And so we know that people will have lots and lots of questions, legitimately. You have to get all these questions answered, and the university is trying very, very, very hard to make sure that anybody who has questions can get them answered. So there are a series of retirement information sessions. These are
on the university's website, HR website, but we will
also put these in our weekly update so that people can find them very quickly. Supervisors, please let eligible members of your groups, please allow them to go to these without any problem. Go to more than one if you've got questions. Set up an individual appointment with someone to walk you through what your process is, because each person's case is a little bit different, but you do have to understand that you've got enough money to retire, that you understand what healthcare insurance implications are, what tax implications are, all of that. I understand that you can get, say you have a full year of retirement that, correct me if I'm wrong, Isabel, but you can receive that in $2 for tax purposes. So all of this is really, really important. Information is good. I personally always like to have a lot of information so that I know what I'm getting into. Please, please avail yourselves of these things. If you don't know or you want to talk to someone too, I mean, the university big HR, university HR, has people to talk to, but you can also talk to Isabel. So some things that people worry about. Who will be eligible for McGill University's post-retirement benefit plans, such as life insurance and health and dental plans? All you can find out at these sessions just what the situation is. And when you retire, all of this stuff doesn't go away. I mean, that's the important thing that people need to understand. Should you choose to retire, you will not lose any vacation days. And depending on retirement date, allowance will be made by the increase in the percentage of salary increase. And if you really want to understand that more, you can talk to Isabel, give her a call, and maybe she'll understand. Maybe.
Which is after the next salary increase, obviously whatever amount is on your letter will be increased by the percentage of salary increase applicable to your step.
Right, so.
In simple terms, what you're trying to say.
Yeah, right. So this applies only to MUNACA staff, the little increase that those members will get. If you retire, will be the base that that your retirement package will be worked on, will be given. Okay. And you will receive pay equity retroactively if it meets the eligible criteria. That has to do with that issue as well.
You're part of one of those people who are affected and are eligible to the new calculation and the retroactivity, this money will be paid to any retired staff. You're not losing that.
So if you are eligible for some of the pay equity retroactive program that many of you know about, that is included as part of this as well. And if you have questions, call this simple number, 4747. Easy. Okay? Okay. Other cost-cutting measures, including layoffs, will likely to be required. I think that everybody understands this. And this is only the second time in my career that I've had to say this. And it's a profound reality and something that I don't think that any of us are crazy about. But those numbers, we simply have to get to those numbers. We have to cut $43 million in recurring money from this budget. And the nature and extent of these layoffs will be influenced, of course, by what comes before. So obviously, we won't have to lay off as many people, depending upon how many people retire. That's why it's a phased-in approach. When people leave, their money, their salaries will be captured. It will, however they leave, whether they choose to leave through retirement or whether they're leave through a layoff program, that money will be captured and will be sucked up into the vortex of the $43 million budget cut. And it goes away because essentially we don't have that money anymore. Okay, library-specific measures. All of the deans in the library, in addition to the broad brush program, broad brush general outlines that I've gone through, were given more specific information. Basically, it comes down to two sort of ideas. One is targeted expense reductions, because we in the library, our target for our part of the $43 million is roughly $2 million in recurring money. So, I mean, if you just want to think that, I don't know, somebody makes $40,000 a year, somebody makes $50,000 a year, somebody makes $60,000 a year, there are people in this room who make all of those. If you want to think of how many people that is to equal that, then you can do it. You can figure out the simple arithmetic. This represents 7% of our total operating budget. For us, we are going to meet this $2 million in reduction. Probably, these are the things that we will have to do. I'll talk about reassignment of staff in a bit. But travel at first, we will be reducing we're going to have to reduce, simply have to reduce, from the get-go, our student wages budget, our casual budget, by 75%. So if you think of all the students who shelve and hustle and who shelve everywhere, our staff is going to have to be doing that work. Travel expenses will be reduced by 25%. This is something that's being mandated by the university. It's one of the things that they specifically say that we need to do. They also say that we need to cut events and parties and catering and all that sort of thing. So we will be reducing all of our events through the library, our big events, not things like Colleen's Coffee that cost us coffee and cookies and are really important in terms of just being able to talk to people. I mean, we can have Colleen's Coffee without coffee. Yeah, right. I mean, the point, those things are really like Dean's Corner. We're not cutting our communication mechanisms because we have to have that more than anything right now. We've been told that we will cut 24-hour access to all of our libraries except during exam periods, unless the students are willing to pay specifically for that, for keeping the buildings open. And as I said, we'll only have one party a year, so there goes the barbecue. That'll be the first thing that you'll see go. There are other, if you want to know about other university-wide cuts, there will be landscaping cuts, cuts in external consultants and legal fees. As I said, reduced library hours cuts, reduced library hours everywhere, and security spending cuts. Okay, so let me just talk a little bit. Well, let me go back. Let me see if I can go back, figure out how to go back to where I was. Okay. What does this really mean for us? I mean, half of the staff and administrative staff is eligible for the retirement incentive program. We don't know. It's very generous. It's up to individuals to decide whether they'll take it or not. Once we know how many people have decided to do that, then we will know, and we've more than nipped and tucked in a whole lot of other places, such as reduction of, elimination really, of 75% of our student budget. We will have to think in terms of closing branch libraries. This is very real, because I've been thinking about this for weeks and months, and it's inevitable. We will not be able to run things as we have with the complex that we have and not do very, very significant things. The bodies and the positions simply aren't out there. If we do not get the number of people, if we don't hit our target by those who retire, then we will have to lay off people. That's somewhere between tragic and terrifying, and it's a very, 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 very profound thing that is going to possibly happen to members of our library and archives family. Any place, obviously, if you look to your left and your right and you think of the work that you have been doing and the way that you've been doing it, primarily, mostly affecting administrative staff and M's that work, and our library staff too, our academic staff. Your work has got to change, because we cannot, obviously, if we have no students working for us, the staff who are here are going to have to fill in those positions, because according to their job descriptions, we can ask them to do that work, and we'll have to. Books can't sit on the floor. We will be moving people. If we close branches, of course, that has profound implications for people moving to different buildings and doing different work in those buildings. In terms of collection services is a very large unit within HUSL, and anything that can be done, anything that can be outsourced, anything that can be done in a different way that is not human resource intensive, we will simply have to do, because we will not have roughly $2 million in human resources that we had today. So, I've been talking ever since I got here about the changes in our world. And I can tell you I would much rather have gone through changes in our world in about any way besides this one. I guess there's nobody in this room who doesn't know what this, the profound effects that this is going to have upon our work and what we do and how we do it and the individuals who work here. But I just need to tell you that in very, very simple and very concrete, unequivocal terms, that we have to cut our budget by $2 million. And there are ways that are outlined that the university has mandated for us. And the only way to do that is real change for this organization as a whole. Okay, so this HR update, I'll get to in a second, or I guess let me take questions here. Yeah. Yeah.
Are you allowed to cut the collection budget?
The collection budget right now is not being slated to be cut. The collection budget will be cut by definition because of cereals inflation, which means that right now it's really a simple arithmetic. We need somewhere between $500,000 and $600,000 in new money every year simply not to have to cut things. Because cereal and database inflation is somewhere between 7 and 10% a year. Our database budget is about $11 million. So you can figure that out really fast. So essentially, by not cutting collections and having no new money, we're cutting collections by around $600,000. Which will have to come, by the way, from monographs. Okay, yes. The question is how will layoffs be done? And my best answer for that is they will be done in conformity with collective bargaining agreements, and they're all a little bit different. But for Munaca, it's basically seniority, right?
Reverse order
of seniority. So those who are newest into the first, last in, first out. Although, never mind. I won't say it. Okay, Brian.
Does this have any impact on those who are having tenure this year?
No.
Positions?
No.
Okay.
Why would you ask that?
Well, I'm just wondering. I'm on the tenure committee. I'm just
wondering
if that's going to
influence
my
No, obviously, you know, the academic staff is the implications of all of this budget cut for academic staff. There are two things. One is the only people MAUT agreed to a hiring freeze, except for a teeny tiny, a staff freeze?
Salary
freeze, sorry, all those S words. A salary freeze of, except for assistant librarians and professors who will get a small 1% across the board increase. So there's no merit, there's just this 1% across the board. There will be a slowdown in replacing academic staff openings. So something on the order of 2 for 4, 1 for 2, or 3 for 4, or whatever. But we're going to have to seriously justify each one of those. And anyone who goes through tenure, I mean, all those tenure clocks, they are just grinding away. Nothing's changed with that. And anyone who is promoted from assistant to associate with tenure will receive the the $5,000 increment that has always been there. We asked that specifically. But you have to listen carefully to what I said. It's those who go from assistant to associate with tenure. Okay. Other questions? Yes, Donna.
I just wanted to ask about that casual budget, because I know a good chunk of our casual budget is provided to us by the SSMU. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if, when you're saying you have a reduction by 75%, if you're factoring that part in, or you have some knowledge that we're not going to get that money this year.
Things are never as simple as this kind of money you always plug in for this use. Everything that we negotiate with SSMU is done on a year-to-year basis. And so we will be going through those negotiations this year. And our anticipation is that no matter where the money comes from, our casual budget will be reduced by 75%. We simply have to do it because we can afford not to have students, and we have to keep staff, because they have permanent employment. Yes?
The other question I wanted to ask is if there has to be job reassignments of any kind because of layoffs or retirements?
Let me make this clear. There will be job reassignments. And I just don't know the magnitude of them, depending upon everything else.
What I'm wondering is, will it all be done within the faculties, or will it be like on a university-wide level?
Well, everything will be done first within the library, insofar as we can control things and fill holes and come up with the numbers that we need, but potentially it could expand outside the library to come up with this total goal of 541 or whatever it is, people whom we have to take off the payroll. Yes?
I'm just wondering what the impact of the temporary ceasing of job rematching is going to have on that. If you transfer staff around to different positions, obviously rematching is part of that. But if you have a rematch freeze, doesn't that exasperate grievances?
No, because we will only move people within their PEDs. They'll only be doing work that will be within their classification, within their PED. But it could very well be done someplace within our organization that is totally different from where they have been. But obviously you can't have people working out of their PEDs. That's wrong. Yeah, I can just say flat out, that's wrong. Yes.
Is that going to stop renovations? Are we going to stop renovations?
Are we going to stop?
I think she's being like sarcastic. Is McGill going to stop their renovations? Is that part of the budget cuts also?
Okay, that was actually the. I think Tony dealt very well with that question in his letter. It was either yesterday or the day before. I'm a little jet lagged. There are all money at universities is not totally fungible and can be used for anything. And this is something that people have always had a really, really difficult time understanding. Our renovation money in the library has primarily come from two places. It's just lapsed salaries that we have saved from year to year and from SSMU money. So that's not university money really in the way that people are thinking about. That money for us is gone. I mean, we've already renovated stuff. It's one-time money. It's gone. We don't have that money lying around to use for something else. There's every major university that I know of in North America has a huge deferred maintenance problem, but it pales in comparison to McGill's. and what Tony, and it's a result of our very old historical structure, heritage structure, and what Tony said is that we will keep up, and what it sounded like to me, we will keep up with maintenance that really has to do with health and safety. So if we have to do things, if we have to do asbestos abatement because some people are in danger, if we have to repair the terrace because someone's about to fall through the ceiling, the floor into the cyber attack, we will do those things that are absolutely required from deferred maintenance money, which, by the way, cannot be used for these other purposes. There is the library budgets, university budgets, 101. There are two big things you have to understand. One is that the difference between recurring money and non-recurring money, and these budget cuts are recurring money. So you have to cut recurring things. People's salaries are recurring because they happen every year. You can't use one-time money for recurring budgets because it's like not putting something in your checkbook and you say, oh, I've got money there, and you spend it on something else. You can't do it. And the other thing with university budgets and library budgets is that there's general purpose money and then there's restricted funds. All of our endowments, for instance, are restricted funds, meaning that they can only be used for the purpose for which an endowment was put together initially. And that is always negotiated with the person who gives the money, and the person who gives the money gets to give the money for the purpose they want to give it for, not necessarily for what you want to use it for. That's all a good thing, because it keeps you, because anytime money goes for anything, it fills up, fills a gap, and then there's money freed up that you can use for other things. So endowments are great. And in this library, they're hugely important because they really, really backfill the collections budget. But most of our endowments are restricted to collections. I'd say 95%, maybe more. Yes?
This might be a dumb question, given that you obviously can't know now, but how would academic staff layoffs come? Like, we don't have seniority structure the way UNACA does, for example. So would it be also done via who's here, like first in or last out? You know,
that is, the question is, what would happen with academic staff if they were laid off? That doesn't happen that way.
They're not even covered.
Yeah, it's not covered in this program. And I can honestly tell you, if academic staff like that were ever laid off, then you have to kill a program. You know, you have to no longer do surgery. Yeah, history, something like that. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yes.
Hi. I'm gonna wear a union hat, and a lot of unions and associations on this campus, and even in this library. And I don't expect you calling to know anything specific,
okay.
Right?
I'll answer just one.
No, but I just from what you presented here, in terms of the retirement offer, obviously, in terms of UNACA, yeah, that's being offered to many, many of our people. And a hiring freeze, obviously, the library, you can decide that, because you're being told not to hire anyone, new people, as of April 2nd. But what we actually have a collective agreement, and in that collective agreement, unless we agree to open it and vote on it as a membership, UNACA's not going to, there'll be no salary freezes, no progression freezes, there'll be no freezes in terms of rematches. We can have rematches unless we open up our collective agreement and vote not to, because it's in our CA. And rematches are going to become really important here in the library. if people, as staff is reduced, and we're going to be working outside of PEDS, and we will, if we're asked to work outside of our PEDS, we will be asking for rematches, and we will be asking for overtime, because there's not going to be enough people to do the work. And that's an issue that hasn't even been brought up here. I mean, how do you pay overtime? I mean, where's the budget for that? But we can only work so many hours in a day. And I'm so appreciative that this is hard, but at the same time, if you look at the seniority list of our membership, and there's 1,700 people on it, you look at the library people, there's, like, as you said, there's so many of us that can go on retirement if we accept this package, and there's quite a few of us that whose jobs are at risk too, and it's who's left to do the work? I mean, really.
I hear exactly what you're saying, and we can't pay overtime because we're not going to be able to afford it.
Okay.
And if people's lives were threatened, if huge health or security or things were threatened, but we are going to reduce our programs and the coverage of our buildings to the point where we don't need so many people working in them. That's what we have to do. It is very, that's what we're going to have to do. We will probably have to close branch libraries and then move the people who are left around. No one is going to work out of their PED. They can't work out of their PED because it's illegal. I totally agree with you on that. I am not going to ask anyone to work out of their PED. I'm not. It's not going to happen. It can't happen. You are absolutely right. Can't happen. But we will ask people to work within the total legal boundaries of a PED. And there's some misunderstanding in this organization, or a lack of common understanding. I won't say misunderstanding. There's a lack of common understanding within the organization and what that means. But a PED is what is written. We can ask you to work within what is written in your PED, not the experience of what you have done in the past, the basis of what you've done in the past. Okay. Any other questions? Yes. If it's a long question, I'm going to have to bring this to you. If it's a short question, I can repeat it. Okay.
Which branch libraries are you thinking about cutting, and how much money would that save?
Right on topic.
Okay. Music is safe. Music is safe. And you're not in music? Where are you? Oh, okay. Okay. Okay, I'm sorry. I don't keep up track with everything. I mean, the question was, what branch libraries are we talking about? Are we talking about closing, and how much money would that save? And I really, let me be really honest here. I had to be honest enough to tell you that this was probably going to happen. But there's no point in my stirring up the nest and making it worse than it has to be until it's real. So I can tell you we're thinking about closing some branch libraries, more than one. You can go out and you can speculate which ones those are. You'll probably come up correctly, you know. But I'm not going to say right now exactly what they are, because I don't know. Until the first domino, this whole phase thing has to happen. The dominoes have to happen before we can figure out what we're going to do. And we're going to take it one step at a time. And as far as how much money is that going to save, I know that this is going to sound circuitous and like I'm not answering the question, but that is not the right question. Because what we have to do, we can't say, if I'm going to close the dean's office, there are 12 people who work there, add up everybody's salary, and that's how much it's saved. because there's still going to have to be someone who answers an HR question, so we have to move someone in from the outside. So how much money have you saved by closing the dean's office when you've moved someone back in there to fill something in? So it's not, so it really isn't quite the right question. The right question and the right answer to that question is, the question is, how much money are we being required to cut from our recurring budget? And that's right at $2 million. And what are the constraints of how are we to cut that? We are to cut it through attrition of payroll and through things like targeted staff hour, opening hours, travel reductions, parties. Look, I like the parties as much as anybody else. We may need more parties, not fewer. And those other things that I can't remember right now. 25% cut in travel spending, cut in events, catering, holiday parties, reduced library hours, security spending cuts, cleaning and landscaping cuts, reduction in use of external consultants and legal fees. And by not getting new money for us, a reduction of over $500,000 in our collections budget by definition. Okay. Any other questions? Yes.
Once you get the numbers on the retirement package, the step to phase two, where layoffs will happen on whatever level, are we talking instantaneous, a delay of a few weeks, inside 3 months? Like, what's that kind of timeline?
All of this, well, the people have to get in their information about retirement by June 1st? By June 3rd. Okay, so that's the first domino to fall. By June the 3rd, we'll know how many people are going to retire. So then we'll start to know how many people will be whom we will have to lay off across the university to come up with the budgeted cuts. And don't forget that this is starting in the fiscal year. The fiscal year starts in May the 1st, so everything's going to happen very quickly. I anticipate that we'll have clarity with what we need to do, if not have already done it, by the beginning of the term in September within the library.
Just to add, we talk about the retirement program, but there's also the other groups' salary increases that we need to have the feedback on, the AMP salary policy, the other collective the different unions on campus. We haven't heard from them yet. So there's multiple dominoes, and that in June we'll know more, and then we'll be able to know exactly
what will
be the extent of the layoffs.
Okay, other questions? Now's the time to get all this off your chest. Anything that you're wondering about, I can assure you there are other people around you who are wondering about too. Yes?
I have a question from afar.
Okay.
Will staff be consulted as part of any proposed job, a change in job duties?
Will staff be consulted in terms of changes of job duties? As a general rule of thumb, I don't like to shake people up for the purpose of shaking them up. Insofar as we can accommodate individuals' needs and wishes, we will do that as in the way that is humane and reasonable. But in the end, we're going to have to keep the buildings open that we choose to keep open and provide library services as we need to, and we will, with $2 million less a year. And I could go to the Association of Research Library Statistics and show you what that reduction in our budget is going to look like compared to other libraries. And you'll see that that there aren't many libraries who could have an extensive branch structure who can keep things open and function with this amount of money. Yes, Valerie,
Long question or short?
Short.
Okay.
If the library were to manage to achieve nearly all of its goal through voluntary retirement, could that possibly affect some of the other measures, or would we still, what happens in the greater university? Like, if we met our goal through, you know, fully through voluntary retirement, but the rest of the university didn't, do we just have to meet it within our own umbrella, or are we affected if other units don't achieve their goal?
Oh, gosh, that's a question that I need to ask as a dean. I mean, if it's like, hey, if I manage to make my cut and you don't, then you need to figure out your problem and not mine. I'll remember that. Right now, I think if we manage to, I will be very unhappy. And I will let people know if once we manage to make our cut that we're not going to get encroached upon anymore. But, I mean, whatever happens, it's just going to be a lot of shifting around to fill up the holes. I mean, it just is. So I wanted to tell people, I told you that I'd always tell you things straight out. And I'm trying my best to. I really, really am. Okay. Other questions?
Is it going to focus on all libraries? All libraries will be reduced the budget. Will other departments be affected? Like, other areas will be affected, or is it only the libraries? Talking about the libraries, but other areas will also be affected?
By budget cuts?
Are they specifically focusing on the libraries, reducing it now more than other departments? So is the library the biggest focus of reduction compared to other departments in Abigail?
Okay, the question is the library being sort of singled out to be one of the areas that where there are bigger cuts, and the answer is no. It's all being done in sort of a percentage basis. What we have to come up with, that roughly $2 million, it's a little bit less than $2 million, but it's roughly $2 million, that cut that we have to take in our recurring budget, the equivalent of that in the specific terms of every faculty in each administrative unit, every dean and administrator has gotten their own goal. And it's all based upon how many people they have in their organization, the makeup of their staff, whether it's, you know, in the faculty, say, of education or law or whatever, 95% of their staffing is all faculty. So their constellation looks very different. If I'm working out at McDonald campus, they have a lot of staff out there, kind of like the library, because they're very staff intensive with the farms and the other things that they do in terms of animal care. So it's as fair as it can be. Yes?
Just to go on the ballot, which was asking. Let's say, what if, this is a hypothetical question like that, we're far away from the 2 mil goal. As you said, I mean, if you take a salary of 50K, that's 40 people at least, okay, to meet that threshold. Give an example of number of managers. So let's say we're far away, and must be having plan B, we have to have more other things to do. Because I know that's, it could be, we don't know, it's just.
Louis is saying that what happens if we can't meet our roughly $2 million goal through staff attrition and these other things, then we'll just find other places to cut. I mean, we have to come up with $2 million. The university doesn't have $43 million that it had yesterday. Okay. Yes.
Can I assume that the swag is going to go away? You know, the library bags, and we've got post-it notes and all sorts of, you know, I mean, I'm sure it's not a great amount of money, but, you know, I realize and everyone seems to love rebranding, but this is not the time.
Someone is saying that we need to be careful about our giveaways, and yeah, we will think very carefully about that, but I guess you can tell that I hardly ever have a black and white answer to almost anything, and there will be times, I think, when it will be to our global benefit to market things very carefully. But I hear what you're saying, and we'll have to be really careful with how things look. Things have to pass the sniff test. Okay, other questions out here? Yes.
Retiring below 60.
If someone is interested in retiring below 60, could that conversation happen? And yes, that conversation could happen. Have to talk with Isabel first. Or your supervisor. I mean, we have some friendly supervisors. We only have friendly supervisors, Isabel says. Okay. Any other questions? Yes.
I was just wondering if there's going to be any consideration if we're looking to have a reduced number of staff, reduced hours, reduced security, and we still have the issue of Fridays off in the summer, if there would be any chance to just closing offices as we did in the past.
A question of closing offices on Fridays in the summer with reduce this and reduce that and reduce that and whatever. And all I can say is right now that we will consider everything that we need to do, but we're here for one purpose, and that purpose is to serve the educational, learning, and research mission of our university clientele. And we're going to manage to do that. We're going to do that. Okay. Anything else? I mean, I really want people to get these questions out. And if you think of something and you're worried about it or you're fretting about it or whatever, try to fret with correct information. I mean, it's totally human nature. I have done it so much myself. I mean, try not to go into worst case scenarios and start creating scenarios that aren't real. I mean, that's it. It's really easy to do that. We are going to get through this. I told you from the day one that our world is really changing. I didn't anticipate it would change this way. I can't tell you how I feel about this. I don't want to tell you how I feel about this. But I can tell you that it is change, and we will, you know, in some ways change can be fun. So if you're one of those people who ends up working someplace else, it may not be the end of the world, I promise you. Maybe doing something they even like doing better. But I am very, very, very worried about the people implications in this, and that's the people who might have to be laid off. I mean, that's what we need to think about. That's what's really the worst. Okay. Other questions, if you have questions, for those of you who have gotten your letter, if you think you should have gotten a letter and you haven't gotten a letter, wait one more day for Montreal's great post office to get it to you. And if you don't get it,
then inquire. We will, should they call Big HR or should they call you?
Both.
Okay.
If you cannot reach 4747, come and see me or
okay. Okay, if you can't reach 4747, then touch bases with Isabel. If you have, I mean, if you're toying with this, I just want to look each one of you in the eyes and say, get real information. There, if you go over and you talk to someone in university HR and you want to know about what it would mean to retire, then by all means do. You can always, going over there and getting information is not the same as making a decision. It's just getting information. And that's hugely important for you to have good information. And the best information is over there when they call up your specific record and they can tell you exactly what it will mean for you. And that's the bottom line. That's what you need to do. And they're not going to ask you to sign right there and pressure you to do it. They're going to give you information so that you can make a decision when you've left and you've had some time to stare at the walls and think about what the right thing for you to do is. Okay. Other things. Okay, so I'm just going to call it quits at this. We've got, I mean, people are wondering about, except I have my last little upcoming events. We've got all this stuff. It's on the weekly update, too. And I've got a friendly little martlet. Just in terms of recruiting for academic staff, you know that we are in process for head of Schulich and head of Hustle. Those are still winding their ways through those through bureaucracies. We will not make organization-wide announcements on those positions until offers and contracts essentially have been signed, meaning that everything has gone through all the hoops because it's not proper to do that. And at least in my view. So those are moving, and we are engaging a search firm for the head of client services, and we're going to call it head of user services, so, and DI. So those are still moving. Okay. Sorry? Well, those are just... Okay, this is just basically what, oh, sorry. Anna DiPietro, I guess people know this, maybe they don't, is now in collection development. Peter Martinek is in collection development. Rebecca Nicholson is in our web support space. Alessandra Scarcia is, gotten a new position, a specialized cataloging editor. And then these are the things that I just mentioned. Okay. I'm sorry. I thought this was old news. Okay. Okay. So I can just leave those up there. Okay. Has everybody gotten all of their questions out? Okay. Thank you.